world in which people were free to speak, a world in which there was a true Bill of Rights, and of course a world in which people had their fundamental economic needs taken care of, would be a world in which people were freer to express themselves, because political rights and free speech rights are really dependent on economic status and having fundamental economic needs taken care of.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn, A World Without Borders. Frontiers divide people into nation-states, leading inevitably to an us-and-them dichotomy. A political elite dominates power and the lexical discourse. Flags become potent symbols of nationalism. Patriotism is used to create the illusion of a common interest that everyone shares. Political leaders exempt themselves from law and basic morality, while all the time loudly proclaiming their adherence to them. They declare that God is on their side. They call on their people to make sacrifices. Vast military power is deployed to defend what is called the national interest. Other countries are attacked. This is called self-defense. This pattern is a formula for endless conflict. What if the barriers dividing people disappeared? Can we imagine a world without borders? Howard Zinn can. Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University, is perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He was born in Brooklyn in 1922. His parents were poor immigrants. During World War II, he saw combat duty as an Air Force bombardier. After the war, he went to Columbia University on the GI Bill. He was an active figure in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements. Today, he speaks all over the country before large and enthusiastic audiences. He's a regular contributor to the Progressive magazine. His masterpiece, A People's History of the United States, continues to sell in huge numbers, as does its companion volume, Voices of a People's History. Professor Zinn and I also did a book together. It's called The Future of History. I talked with him in the offices of the Harvard Trade Union Program in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, Howard Zinn.
Thank you, David.
I want to ask you about how politicians use history as a kind of mystical element or device. For example, we often hear that the U.S. is called upon by history to do certain things in the world. Could you perhaps shed some, as they say, shed some light on this mysterious topic?
History is always a good entity to call upon if you're hesitant to call upon God. You see, because they both play the same role. You know, they're both abstractions. They both are actually meaningless until you invest them with meaning. And so I've noticed that President Bush calls upon God a lot. And I think he's hesitant to call upon history because I think the word history throws him. He's not quite sure what to do with it, but he's more familiar with God. But, history is invoked because nobody can say what history really has ordained for you, just as nobody can say what God has ordained for you. And so it's an empty vessel which you can fill in whatever way you can. And so you can say that history has decided that the United States will be the great leader of the world, and that the American values being another empty vessel which you can fill with anything you want, American values will be transmitted to the rest of the world. So you can fill history, that abstraction history, with anything you want, use it whatever you want, and people who are political leaders suppose that the population is as mystified by the word history as they are by the word God, and that therefore they will accept whatever interpretation of history is given to them by their political leaders. And so the political leaders feel free to declare that history is on their side, and the way is open for them to use it in whatever manner they want.
There are contrasting views on what the term well-educated means. When you hear it, what occurs to you? What constitutes being well-educated?
Well, I suppose there's an orthodox view of what it means to be well-educated, and the orthodox view is, a person is well-educated, who has gone through all the realms of education, and the higher up you go, the more degrees you have, the better educated you are. The more knowledge you have, the more facts you have acquired, the more languages you can speak, the more important people you can quote, the more reading you have done. All of that falls within the orthodox definition of higher education, of education itself, of being well educated, and it's and of course a lot of that is legitimate, and a lot of that makes sense, but it's not sufficient for me. That is, to me, being well educated means not just sort of a mastery of information, not just a quantity of information. But to me, being well-educated means being educated in what is important and what is not important, educated in having a sense of proportion about what knowledge is significant and what knowledge is not significant, what knowledge is trivial and what knowledge has in very powerful ramifications, what knowledge can contribute to the betterment of society and what knowledge is really just sort of static information lying there, whether in the book or in the head, but which has no energy which it propels into society to have an effect on whatever is going on in society.
You've been a lifelong reader from the time you found Tarzan and the Jewels of Opar in the street with the first few pages torn out. Later, your parents got you the complete collection of Charles Dickens' novels. We live in an age of sound bites today and eye bites, quick bursts of information. What's the value of reading?
It's interesting that even in this age of sound bites, as you say, even this age when television has taken over the lives of so many people, especially the younger people of this generation, but really of all people, and when therefore there's less time to read, simply less time to read and less opportunity to read, still, even in this time, books are important and people turn to books, and obviously people are still reading. Millions of books are sold. And I do believe that books have a lasting impact, which television and movies, the sound bites of radio, do not have. No. Because I realize I'm talking to a person in alternative radio. But I do believe that there is an effect in reading which is more profound than the effect of watching or listening, even though those may be very influential. And, of course, I've spoken to people who are very, very much affected by something they saw on television, some movie they saw, some lecture they listened to on radio, some person who said something on radio and awakened something in them. And yet, whenever I've spoken to people about books that they've read, it seemed to me that the effect of the books was much more long-lasting and profound. I'll put it another way, and I don't know if my experience agrees with the experience of other people, but I have talked to people, young people especially, who would say to me, this book changed my life. I remember sitting in a cafeteria in Hawaii across from a student at the University of Hawaii, and the student had before her a copy of The Color Purple by Alice Walker. And since Alice Walker had been my student at Spelman College, because I didn't immediately say, that's my student. No, I wouldn't do that, but I sort of cautiously said, you're reading The Color Purple. What do you think of it? And the student said, this book changed my life. And that was that startled me, a book that changed your life. And I must say, in all modesty, that I have run a number of times, and won't tell you how many times, into students who have read my book, A People's History of the United States, and who said, in ways that I first did not believe, but I'm almost beginning to believe it now, the students would say, your book changed my life. And so, and there were books, I think, that changed my life, and you mentioned Dickens, and I think reading Dickens changed my life. Reading Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath changed my life. Reading Upton Sinclair, yes, changed my life.
Today, education, the classroom, is a battleground. There are debates about the canon and what books are being taught and what topics. There are charges that campuses are run by leftists, by Marxist professors. David Horowitz is the principal among these who promotes these kinds of ideas. Now, from your perspective over the years, is this more acute now? Or do we know more about this topic now because of the media? Or has it been rather, ebbs and flows?
There's always been conflict in the educational world. There's always been a scrutiny of what young people learn, a scrutiny of their textbooks, a scrutiny of their teachers. And for a simple reason, that education has always been dangerous to the establishment. And therefore, the risk that is taken when young people go into the classroom is a risk that the people in charge of the status quo want to watch very carefully. Back in the 1950s, during the McCarthy period, Harold Velde, the congressman from Illinois, got up to talk about a proposal in Congress to fund mobile library units to go into rural areas, with trucks of books, because the people in rural areas did not have access to libraries. And Velde got up and opposed this idea of mobile libraries because he said education is the first step towards communism. Well, I don't think it's quite literally true. I think it is true that education has dangerous possibilities, always has had, and therefore it is guarded very, very carefully. And attempts to control it have always existed. Now the question is, what is going on now? Is this a more intense attempt to control the education of young people than we have had in the past? And I think that may be so for one reason, and that is, the stakes today for the United States are higher than they ever were before. That is, with the United States the predominant power in the world and seeking to establish its power, assert its power, consolidate its power, extend its power into more areas of the world. There's an enormous amount at stake for the establishment and bringing up a generation of young people who will accept what the United States government does, who will not be critical of it. And in such a situation where so much is at stake, where an empire is at stake, then it becomes more important to make sure that young people are not becoming critical of this empire, that we're not producing a young generation of skeptics and activists. And I think that may account for the special intensity today of the search for Marxists or leftists in the educational system.
The Canadian-born economist John Kenneth Galbraith once said that the paradox of the United States was private wealth and public squalor. You just mentioned John Steinbeck, the novelist, and libraries. Here's a story on page 16 in the New York Times. In John Steinbeck's hometown of Salinas, California, where they're facing record deficits, the town is closing the three public libraries, including those named for Steinbeck and one for Cesar Chavez. Salinas is a town of 150,000, a blue-collar town, largely composed of poor farm workers and immigrants. And the article goes on to write that this is part of a larger pattern. Libraries around the country are encountering hard times, that libraries in 41 states absorb more than $50 million in financing cuts in the last year, and more than 1,100 libraries have reduced operating hours or trimmed their staffs. And the administrative manager of the Steinbeck branch that's closing, her name is Jan Neal, said, and I'm quoting, "Operating a library isn't as simple as selling cans of tomato soup at a retail store."
It's interesting that that item appeared on page 16 of the New York Times. It should have appeared on page 1. because if it appeared on page 1, it might alert more people to what is really a horrifying development today, and that is with the huge sums of money going to war, with the military budget presented by Bush just calling for over $400 billion plus another $80 billion to pay for wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In this kind of situation, there is no money for libraries, no money for schools, no money for art programs in schools, no money for medical care, for hospitals, for health centers, for legal aid for the poor, for scholarships for students. What is happening to these libraries is symptomatic of something larger in society, and that is the depletion of the wealth of this country for the purposes of war and the starving of human resources in education and health. And so that what is happening in Salinas, California, should be a wake-up call. Unfortunately, I would guess that this item has not been broadcast on national television and has not appeared probably in most newspapers around the country. It appears on page 16 of the New York Times, but it is something that is so far going unnoticed. And to me, it would be a very important, very important thing to bring this to the attention of a larger public, because I think it does have an immediate resonance with most people. I think most people like to see libraries closed. Most people would like to see their kids go to libraries and have books available to them. And I think if this were made a national issue, and this very stark question would be posed to people, would you rather have your tax money go for libraries? Or would you have rather have your tax money go for war? I think the result of that would be an overwhelming one in favor of the libraries. But it's an example of the concealing, page 16, the concealing of information which might excite a population to action.
And, of course, it doesn't get the kind of incessant attention that, say, the breakup of Hollywood stars like Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston. But doesn't this attack on libraries, on schools, do you see it as part of a pattern in terms of undermining the commons?
What is happening to the public common? That is what Galbraith pointed to, you know, back when he wrote The Affluent Society, and what has been really one of the terrible consequences of the militarization of the country is the starving of the public sector, the starving of education, of libraries, of health, of housing, and instead, of course, the pouring of money into activities which are enormously profitable for corporations. I mean, this is why people become socialists. People become socialists in the way that I became a socialist when I read Upton Sinclair and when I read Karl Marx, just to make it a little more dangerous. And that is the understanding that when you have a society where the production of things is based on their profitability, then the things that are not profitable will not be produced. And it is profitable to produce high-rise luxury apartments. It is profitable to build banks and insurance companies, skyscrapers, as we have here, you know, in Boston, the tallest buildings, and not residential buildings for poor people there. They're John Hancock and Prudential. It is profitable to do those things, but it's not profitable to build housing for poor people. You know, it is profitable to build nuclear weapons, profitable to build attack aircraft and helicopters, and it is not profitable to build libraries or to build healthcare centers. So that, I talked about the militarization of society, but even before the United States began to turn an enormous amount of its wealth over to war, even before that, the very fact that we were a capitalist society based upon the profit motive meant that profit came first. After all, when Roosevelt confronted a depression and when the nation was in economic chaos, the nation had not yet become a militarized nation, but the nation had been a capitalist country, and in a capitalist country, the needs of people came second to the needs of big business. So this has been a constant factor in the United States as a capitalist society, only exacerbated by the militarization of the country.
Without overstating what ancient Athens was, let's say it was some kind of functioning democracy. It wasn't, of course. And it was always juxtaposed with Sparta, a highly militarized, aggressive, bellicose state. Do you see the U.S. Drifting closer to Sparta?
Well, I suppose to drifting may be an understatement. I think we're moving closer and closer to a controlled society. But, you know, it may be that the United States will be more like Athens than like Sparta, more like Athens in this sense, that Athens had a kind of semblance of democracy. It had a veneer of democracy, but essentially Athens was controlled by an elite who maintained a slave society and who went to war for empire. In that sense, the United States resembled Athens more than Sparta, but it also, you might say, like Athens, became more like Sparta as wars became more frequent, as the society became more militarized here in the United States, we have become closer to the control of ideas and information, control of people's movements, the detention of people without trial, the destruction of the Bill of Rights. Just as Athens, when it embarked on the Peloponnesian War against Sparta, Athens became a less free society and a more cruel society. And I think in that sense, the United States is playing the same kind of role.
You mentioned Karl Marx and the influence he had on you. There are lots of distortions and misrepresentations attached to Marx, his name, and it, as Marxist and Marxism have become terms of derision and deprecation. Should people be reading Marx today? And if so, why?
Well, yes, I think people should be reading Marx, and I wouldn't advise them to immediately plunge into volume 2 or 3 of Das Kapital, and maybe not even volume 1, which is formidable. But I think the Communist Manifesto, although the title may scare people, the Communist Manifesto is still very much worth reading. Because what it does is to suggest to people who will read it that this capitalist society we have today is not eternal. The Communist Manifesto presents a historical view of the world in which we live. It shows you that societies have evolved from one form to another, one social system to another, from very primitive communal societies to feudal societies to capitalist societies, and that the capitalist society it's only come into being in the last few hundred years, and it came into being as a result of the inadequacy of the feudal society, the failure of feudal society to deal with the change in technology, which was sort of inexorably happening, and commercialization, industrialization, and new tools and implements, and capitalist society was able to deal with this new technology and to enhance it enormously. But what Marx pointed out, and I think this is a very important insight, is that capitalist society, while it developed the economy in an enormously impressive way, increased geometrically the number of goods available, and nevertheless, capitalist society did not distribute the results of this enormous production equitably. The result being a small rich class and a large class of people who did not benefit from this enormous production.
You're listening to Howard Zinn, A World Without Borders. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. 844-444-1977, or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
So Marx pointed to a fundamental flaw in capitalism, a flaw which should be evident to people today, especially in the United States, where the United States is this enormously productive and advanced technological country, and yet a country which has 40 million people without health insurance, where one out of five children grow up in poverty, where there are millions of people homeless and millions of people hungry in this country. What Marx does is to look at this fact, which almost anybody who looks at the United States today can see, and to put it in a historical context and to say the system which produced this came into being. It does not always have to exist. There could be another way of producing and distributing goods in society which would be more equitable, more human, where human needs would come first. And I think that insight, reading Marx, would be important to people. I think another thing that would be important is Marx's class analysis, that is Marx's view that when you look beneath the surface of political conflicts or cultural conflicts, you find class conflict. That the important question to ask in any situation is, who benefits from this? What class benefits from this? If Americans understood this Marxian concept of class, then they would, when they went to the polls and they had to choose between the Republican and Democratic parties, they would ask, which class does this party represent? Which class does this party represent? When they studied legislation put up before Congress and the Bush administration proposed a certain tax program, people would ask, which class does this benefit, this tax program? They wouldn't simply be doing what the newspapers do, and they put the whole issue in terms of generalities, tax cut or tax raise, with no indication of which class will be hurt by this tax cut, which class will benefit by this rise in taxes. So a class analysis that people find in reading Marx, I think, would be very useful in understanding American society today.
Talk a bit about patriotism and the uses of the flag, particularly in the current context. There was a parade in Taos, New Mexico, a march to the plaza on February 15th, 2003, and the banner read, "No flag is large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people." And that's a quote from you. And how is patriotism being used today?
Well, patriotism is being used today the way patriotism has always been used, and that is to try to sort of encircle everybody in the nation into a common cause, the cause being the support of war and the advance of national power. Patriotism is used to create the illusion of a common interest that everybody in the country has. I spoke a minute ago about the necessity to see society in class terms, to realize that we do not have a common interest in our society. People have different interests. What patriotism does is pretend to a common interest. The flag is the symbol of that common interest. And so the patriotism plays the same role that certain phrases in our national language play, and that is to create the illusion of common interest. The words that are used are national security, pretending that there is only one security for everybody, one kind of security for everybody. National interest, pretending one interest for national defense, pretending that the word defense applies equally to all of us. So patriotism is a way of mobilizing people for causes which may not be in the people's interest.
I think it was Mark Twain, if I could paraphrase him, at one point, at a time of another surge in U.S. Imperialism in the around 1900, he said that he supports the country all the time and the government when it earns it.
Well, that I think is a very important distinction that Mark Twain captured in that statement, the distinction between country and government. And you will hear young people who are marching off to war being interrogated by television reporters and asked, why are you going to Iraq or wherever they are being sent to at the time? And the young person will say, I'm going to fight for my country. Well, that requires a very close examination. Is this young person going to fight for his or for her country? Or is that person going to fight for the government? It is the government that has decided on war. It is not the country. It is not the people who decide on war. It is a small group of people in Washington who decided on war and who are now trying to get everybody in the country to support this war by saying this war is for the benefit of the country. But no, the country is not the government. I mean, this is a point made by the, Declaration of Independence, a fundamental philosophical statement of democracy in our history, that governments are artificial creations set up by the people to support the equal right of people to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And when governments become destructive of those purposes and those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. Those are the words of the Declaration of Independence. So the Declaration of Independence makes that distinction. Governments are artificial entities. They are not the country. The country is the people. So Twain's distinction is enormously important for people to understand if they are not to be swept up in what Kurt Vonnegut called a grand falloon, that is this great abstraction which envelops people into an artificial unity.
The United States is the only country in history to use weapons of mass destruction. 2005 marks the 60th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That anniversary, incidentally, comes amidst reports just today that the U.S. is redesigning atomic weapons that would be sturdier and more reliable and to have longer lives. Where were you when the bombs were dropped, and do you remember your thoughts at the time?
Well, I remember very clearly, because I had just returned with my crew, my Air Force crew from Europe. We had been flying bombing missions in Europe, and the war in Europe was over, but the war in Asia with Japan was still on. And we flew back to this country in late July of 1945, and I was given a 30-day furlough. We were all given a 30-day furlough before reporting back for duty, with the intention that we would then go over to the Pacific and continue in the air war against Japan. And I had been married just before going overseas, and my wife and I decided on this 30-day furlough that we would go off into the country for a little vacation, and we were there waiting at the bus stop to take us into the country, and there was this newsstand, and the big headline, atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And I remember my immediate reaction because the headline was so big. Although I didn't know what an atomic bomb was, I assumed it must be a huge bomb, and my immediate reaction was, well, maybe then I won't have to go to Japan. Maybe this means the end of the war in Japan. So I was happy. My wife was happy. And I must say, it was not until the end of the war, really, not until I was discharged from the Army, the war was over, not until then did I think back to the bombing of Hiroshima. Not until then I began to question the bombing of Hiroshima. And that questioning began when I read John Hersey's book, Hiroshima, which is based on a series of articles he wrote for The New Yorker. He had gone to Hiroshima after the bombing, spoke to survivors. You can imagine what the survivors looked like, with people without arms, without legs, blinded, their skin something that you couldn't bear to look at. John Hersey spoke to these survivors of Hiroshima and wrote down their stories. And when I read that, for the first time, the effects of bombing on human beings came to me. Here I had dropped bombs in Europe, but I had not seen anybody on the ground, because when you're bombing from 30,000 feet, you don't see anybody, you don't hear screams, you don't see blood, you don't know what's happening to human beings, you don't see kids with mangled limbs, you know. And so I had really had no idea what the human consequences of my bombs were. Of course, this tells me today how easy it is for American pilots to fly over Iraq or any other place and drop bombs and not really know what they are doing to human beings. But so when I read John Hersey, it came to me what bombing did to human beings, and it profoundly, we talked before about a book profoundly changing your life. That book profoundly changed my idea, not just about bombing, but it profoundly changed my view of war, because it made me realize that war now in our time, in the time of high-level bombing and long-range shelling and death at a distance, that war in our time inevitably means the indiscriminate killing of huge numbers of people, and therefore cannot be accepted as a way of solving problems.
The U.S. has not only not renounced nuclear weapons, it's redesigning its arsenal. And unless I'm missing something, this is not of any great moment.
The fact is that American nuclear armament has proceeded since the end of World War II with the acquiescence of all the major cultural institutions, and in fact with the cooperation of educational institutions, which participated in scientific development of so many of these newer weapons. But certainly the press, television, radio, newspapers, have always gone along with this, have not criticized this, even though it has been so obvious to anybody who looked at the situation for more than 5 minutes, that the United States was arming itself far, far beyond any possible need to defend this country against attack. And so I'm not really surprised that this news of development of new nuclear weapons is going, you know, without criticism. Of course, the real problem will be how will the American people respond, and how can an anti-war movement respond to this, and how can an anti-war movement, which is concentrated right now on the war in Iraq, realize that quietly behind the more overt actions in Iraq, quietly behind the scenes, the United States is increasing its nuclear capacity.
You're sometimes described as an anarchist or a democratic socialist. Are you comfortable with those terms, and what do they mean to you?
How comfortable I am with those terms depends on who's using them. David, I'm not uncomfortable when you use them. but if somebody is using them who I suspect does not really know what those terms mean, then I feel uncomfortable because I feel they need clarification. Because after all, the term anarchist to so many people means somebody who throws bombs, somebody who commits terrorist acts, somebody who believes in violence. Oddly enough, the term anarchist is not applied to governments that use bombs on an enormous scale, but the anarchist has always applied to individuals who have used violence. And so the term anarchism has very often means that to people. And since I do not believe in throwing bombs or believe in terrorism or in violence, I don't want that definition of anarchism to apply to me. Or anarchism is also misrepresented as being a society in which there's no organization, there's no responsibility, that is a kind of chaos. Again, not realizing the irony of a world which is very chaotic, of a society which is very chaotic, but to which the word anarchism is not applied. Now, to me, the philosophy of anarchism, to me, as I've only really since the 60s began to learn, reading the autobiography of Emma Goldman, reading Alexander Berkman, reading Kropotkin and Bakunin, and learning something about anarchism. Anarchism to me means a society in which you have a really democratic organization of society, of decision-making, of the economy, in which the authority of the capitalist is no longer there, the authority of the police and the courts and all of the instruments of control that we have in modern society, in which they do not operate to control the actions of people, and in which people have a say in their own destiny, in which they're not forced to choose between two political parties, neither of which represents their interests. So I see anarchism as meaning both political and economic democracy in the best sense of the term. And I see socialism as, which is another term which I would accept comfortably, socialism as meaning not the police state of the Soviet Union, and not, after all, the word socialism has been commandeered by too many people who, in my opinion, not socialists, but totalitarians. But to me, socialism means a society which is egalitarian, and which the economy is geared to human needs instead of to business profits.
The theme of the World Social Forum, which is held annually, is Another World is Possible. If you were to close your eyes for a moment, what kind of world might you envision?
Well, the world that I envision, and I'm sure it will come to pass in a few weeks, is a world, first of all, you might say represented by the fact that 100,000 people came together in the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil. And by that I mean these are people who came from all over the world and who discarded their nationalist pride and nationalist hostility when they came together and tried to create a solidarity among people all over the world. So the world that I envision is a world in which national boundaries no longer exist, in which you can move from one country to another with the same ease in which we can move from Massachusetts to Connecticut today, in a world without passports or visas or immigration quotas, that is a true globalization in the human sense, in which we recognize that the world is one and that human beings everywhere have the same rights. In a world like that, you could not make war. In a world like that, because it is your family. It is just as we here in this state will not make war on another, will not think of making war on an adjoining state or even a far-off state. No, war comes from the from the creation of interests, which are national interests, and which see people who live across another border as enemies. A world without borders could not have enemies that you can make war on. And it would be a world in which the riches of the world would be distributed in an equitable fashion, in which where we wouldn't have the kind of situation we have today of rich countries and poor countries, of countries where everybody, industrialized countries, where everybody at least has access to clean water, and the rest of the world where 1 billion people have no access to clean water. So it would be a world in which, and yes, that would take some organization. It would to make sure that the riches of the earth are distributed according to human need, and a world in which people were free to speak, a world in which there was a true Bill of Rights, and of course a world in which people had their fundamental economic needs taken care of. Would be a world in which people were freer to express themselves because political rights and free speech rights are really dependent on economic status and having fundamental economic needs taken care of. But, I think it would be a world in which the boundaries of race and religion and nation would not become causes for antagonism, even though there would still be cultural differences and still be language differences, but there would not be causes for violent action of one against the other. And I think it would be a world in which people would not have to work more than a few hours a day, which is possible without technology. It's possible with the technology available today. If this technology were not used in the way it is now used for war and for wasteful activities, people could work 3 or 4 hours a day and produce enough to take care of any needs. And so it would be a world in which people have more time for music and sports and literature and just living in a human way with others.
You've said that you got into history for a very modest reason. You said, I wanted to change the world. How would you assess your goal? How close have you come to it?
As I said, I'm just a few weeks away. Well, all I can say is, I hope that by my writing and by my speaking and whatever I've done, by my activity, that I have moved at least a few people towards a greater understanding, and moved at least a few people towards becoming more active citizens. And so I feel that if that my contribution, along with the contribution of millions of other people, if they continue, and if they are passed on to more and more people, and if our numbers grow, then one day, I won't give a date, one day we may very well see the kind of world that I envision.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, David. Always a pleasure talking with you.
You are just listening to an interview with Howard Zinn, A World Without Borders. I talked with him at the offices of the Harvard Trade Union Program in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Howard Zinn, professor emeritus at Boston University, is perhaps this country's premier radical historian. Today, at 83, he remains active and writes and lectures on history, politics, and against war. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since its inception in 1986, AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Tariq Ali, Michael Parenti, Cindy Sheehan, Scott Ritter, Arundhati Roy, Noam Chomsky, Robert Fisk, and Cornel West. We also have a series of programs with Howard Zinn. To access our vast catalog, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, tape, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Howard Zinn, A World Without Borders, and to order the book, The Future of History, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.